America, we might start with 2 Chronicles 7:14, beginning in God's house.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. But before we get to our regularly scheduled guest this evening, I want to briefly cover several of the propositions on the ballot here in California. The first is Proposition 37, vitally important that that be passed because, of course, it will require that any genetically modified food sold in California would have to be labeled. And since a lot of those foods are packaged elsewhere, it would mean that all across America, people would know when they're getting genetically modified food. Now, genetically modified food produce cancer, they produce infertility. Certainly, we have all sorts of studies showing how safe they, unsafe they are. In multiple animals, there's a recent study that came out of France where they actually fed rats this genetically modified food for up to about 6 months. And basically, the incidence of breast cancer in these rats, in female rats, was certainly about 5 to 6 times what it was in the rats that weren't fed these products. And the males got destruction of their liver and their pancreas and their kidneys. They know how toxic these are to people, and that's why they have them out. Monsanto that makes certainly the genetically modified foods for most of them. Monsanto is working with Bill Gates, who's totally dedicated to population control, and with the Rockefeller Foundation. They've actually established the Doomsday Seed Bank up to about 600 to 800 miles from the North Pole, where they're storing heritage seeds, good seeds, to use when they start in all over again. I believe this is a program of genocide. And if you'd like to get more on genetically modified food, go up on the internet and look at the articles Dr. Blaylock has written. You'll be horrified. That's why Proposition 37 is so important and why they've spent so much money to defeat it. The other is Proposition 30, which should be defeated. Why? Because, of course, it's basically a scam to get more money from the people. They tell you, oh, my goodness, you know, the children are going to suffer if you don't pass this. Ladies and gentlemen, instead, if they have a shortage, they've been spending far too much money, $94 billion budget here last year. And so what do they want to do? Well, they're saying, if you don't give us more money, we're going to take and we're going to hurt the children. We're going to take, certainly, and destroy the educational system, and it's going to be your fault. Why don't they cut money from everybody all across the board? Because they've targeted the children, ladies and gentlemen. Governor Jerry Brown has targeted the children, and almost 90% of all the cuts will come in education, not in all the other boondoggles that they have. And this isn't going to solve the problem. There's not going to be one more dollar for children as a result of this being passed. This is all a scam. No on 30, no on 38. In my estimation, you may disagree. If you do, give us a call. We'd love to let you have your say on Monday. But right now, let me suggest that these are very, very important. Read what you can find on the internet, and then understand that they've targeted the children, and if you don't give them the money, they're going to hurt the children. They're going to hurt the children. They're going to punish the children if you don't give them the money. Well, I guess right now, Dr. Ellithorpe, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Dr. Stan Monteith. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
I'm blessed. Thank you.
Well, forgive me for my diatribe, but I just wanted to get that information out to the people here in California who are listening to our program, although the program does go out all over the country. But, of course, these are two very important issues. Genetically modified foods are not safe for human consumption. They're not safe for animal consumption, and they know it, and that's why they're giving them to us. We'll be back in just a moment here with Dr. Tabita Ellithorp, and we're going to be talking about health and what you can do to maintain your health today. Well, Dr. Ellithorp, you go right ahead, and I'm going to be quiet now. So you go ahead and then talk about certainly the patients that you're seeing with chronic fatigue and with all of these other systemic diseases and how you're able to help them. Please go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Dr. Montes. It's a pleasure to be on your radio program, Radio Liberty, and it's a privilege to be able to speak and still have the constitutional right to do so. And that, to be a physician that can look at a patient and make a decision how they want to run their own practice, if they want to spend a lot of time with their patient or they need more time, make less money because you don't see a lot of patients. I mean, physicians today, they go through medical school. I went through in the 70s, and we were taught the physiology, the normal physiology, and then we were taught pathology, abnormal, genes and diseases and infections and viruses and trauma. But what we weren't taught was the loop back to how to restore ourselves to normal physiology. It was almost as if once you're ill, once you have high blood pressure, we were taught we did not know the cause. Once you have heart disease, we weren't taught how to return to normal cardiovascular health. That wasn't a term even used. We were then just taught pharmaceutical interventions to assist in blood pressure reduction, cholesterol medications to reduce cholesterol, not to even consider what causes high cholesterol. And so we were taught disease management, not health care. And that's why I have such a poor outlook on what any form of government intervention in health would be, because once you have the force of government dictating any type of commerce, and it is commerce to be a physician. I provide a service, and I should be paid for it. And if I make a mistake, I should pay for that mistake as well. And so that's a healthy relationship. But when you have a third party stuck in between, such as the insurance companies now mandating what they will and will not pay for, then it makes the physician start practicing to conform to the biggest insurance providers, and this creates not health, but wealth for people who have, stock in insurance companies. And
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Rita Ellithorp, just talking about what it is to be a doctor today. And, of course, I attended a meeting at the local hospital today, and it was put on by a doctor who deals with doctors with emotional problems. And he was talking about how the incidence of suicide is 3 to 4 times as high in doctors as in the general population. How most of our doctors today, or so many of them, have emotional problems. They're overworked. They're overstressed. They really are having difficulty coping. And ladies and gentlemen, they're not working the hours I did when I went to medical school in those years. We used to work 12, 14 hours a day. We never thought about being burnt out. We were there to take care of the patients, but now they have to spend so much time on paperwork, and you are not allowed to treat patients the way you want to. You treat them the way everybody else treats them. And as long as, of course, you're tied up with this whole system of government and government regulation and bureaucracies and government organizations and medical organizations that certainly go right along with the government programs, doctors are going to have more and more problems. There's a shortage of doctors today. More doctors are coming into America from other countries, from India, from Pakistan. And it's going to be very soon like it is over in England, where, of course, because most of the doctors don't even speak English and you need an interpreter so that you can talk to your doctor. This is what they plan for America as they set out to destroy the practice of medicine, which at one time was the envy of the world. But there's no problem facing a medicine today that a new government program won't make worse. Dr. Ellithorpe, you pick up the story and talk a little bit about these patients that you see have gone to doctor to doctor to doctor, and they said they just haven't been able to get any help at all with these chronic conditions that they have. But you go right ahead with the story.
Well, one of the things is we made a decision that we're going to trust the Lord to give us an income and survive. That is a humble lifestyle. I don't live, with Mercedes, and I can only rent a house here. But that's wonderful because I'm happy. Because the other way I get payment is when my patients follow up, they're getting better. For the general statement, I'm not saying that I don't have end-stage cancer patients that do pass on. But I certainly don't see them with the disability and the long, chronic, drawn-out diseases. They're much more active and viable until the last few days. But one of the interesting things outside of that general statement is, let's take an example. I saw a gentleman, 60 years old. He owns a company, a factory that produces furniture. This gentleman has been active all of his life. When he was in college at age 20, he developed a seizure disorder. So he's been on Tegretol all his life from 20 to age 60. And about maybe 6 months ago, he started having memory problems and direction problems to the point that he'd be heading the wrong direction on the highways here. He wouldn't show up for his business meetings on time. His wife was frantic. He couldn't remember names and dates. So obviously they were thinking, dementia, Alzheimer's disease. They went to the neurologist. The neurologist was going to start him on a medication. Aricept is usually the entry medicine. And he did not want to just roll over and do that. Somehow he heard of our clinic. He came. And what we talked to him about was trying to find out from his birth on up, what his blood type was, what his illnesses, allergies, how inflamed and reactive a person he was. Did he have tummy troubles, allergies, eczema? Did he have, injuries? And all these things add up in life, what his level of stressors were, how many children he fathered. And when you take that kind of a history, we found out that he had blood type O. He was very allergic to dairy and wheat, and of course dairy with homogenization, pasteurization inflames you, and the wheat products and some of the GMO aspects of the corn and such inflamed him. He had gut inflammation. His stool studies showed inflammatory products of white blood cells. His capillary tests, blood flow was diminished, and so you can assume that it was diminished to his brain. He had high cholesterol, no one ever knew why, and he was eating breads and breakfasts and grains and cereals and pastas and salads and fruits and some fish and a little meat here and there. And we changed him to a very lower carbohydrate diet. We gave him good probiotics. We gave him chelation therapy. We gave him high-dose vitamin C. And his triglycerides, went from like 150 down to 50. His blood pressures of like 140 over 80 dropped to 115 over 65. His memory started returning with chelation therapy. His bowel movements improved. His allergies improved. His memory improved. And they were just astounded at his immediate turnaround. I had another woman
Well,
come.
Before we go on, you mentioned chelation therapy, and I think that this is so vitally important. The average individual certainly doesn't know what chelation is, and the average doctor is not going to be looking for the metals, the aluminum, the mercury, the lead, and the other metals that are involved in poisoning us. They're never around them all the time. They can be chelated, they can be gotten out, but they're only going to be gotten out if people realize, of course, that we're being constantly poisoned. poisoned with the aluminum, certainly that's in the air, that they're pumping into the air, with certainly the aluminum that they put in the vaccines that they give us, the mercury that's certainly in our light bulbs, in our dental fillings, in our vaccines. There's no safe dose of mercury. So why are they putting it into our dental fillings? Why are they putting it into the vaccines? They know what they're doing. They just don't want the people to know. What are some of the other metals that you're looking for?
Well, he was using antacids a lot. He had O-type blood makes a lot of stomach acids, which can be good for digesting proteins and fat. However, he also had trouble with the excess acidity and took aluminum-based antacids a lot. He also used non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which created more gut permeability, which created a generalized inflammation and leaky gut. And so his deodorant had aluminum in it, his antacids had aluminum in it, he had the vaccines, he followed along whenever they said to do a preventive flu shot, and he had the amalgams in his teeth, he had those removed as well. And so, yes, he had many different sources through which he was getting this. He used fluoridated mouthwashes and toothpaste. All these are known to be brain neurotoxic elements. So he cleansed himself of his dental amalgams. We calmed his gut with natural antacids. We changed his diet to reduce the stickiness of all the excess carbs. We advised him on organic sources, wild fish, free-range poultry, grass-fed beef, low-carb vegetables, salads. We took out all his food allergies. We chelated him. EDTA is the amino acid that's been used for about 70 years. When I was at Cook County Hospital back in the 70s, they still had lead-based paint, and little babies would gnaw on the cribs painted with this, and we would have the not infrequent example of a kid coming in with the neurotoxic effects of lead acute intoxication from chewing lead-based chips. And so we would give them this amino acid, and we would save these kids' lives for their nerves, you know, their brain tissue. So I chelated this gentleman. I also gave him high-dose vitamin C as a powerful antioxidant, and we know that EDTA removes the oxidative stress of heavy metals. 100% of every patient I've ever tested to screen for heavy metals flowing in their blood, it's there. It's in us. We're in the 21st century. We're all involved with this.
And you're going to find probably close to 80% of the people will have, or maybe even more than that, that will have these metals in them. And these metals are toxins. Now, are you using oral applied study of transdermal, or using rectal EDTA?
I was involved in the research for the rectal suppositories of EDTA. We did the animal studies. We used carbon-labeled C14, and we were able to track the pharmacokinetics of the distribution of the EDTA, and we found the tissue penetration with the rectal suppository was actually superior to the IV. So this gentleman was given both suppository and intravenous, as well as intravenous IVC, high-dose vitamin C. And I'm telling you, within 3 months, this man had a complete turnaround. So they're happy, and all my other patients with early onset dementia and stuff, we put them through the same protocol, autoimmune diseases, because if you can improve the circulation to the tiny, tiny little capillaries from the brain to the toe, every part of your body gets better. And if we know that we take out free radical cell membrane damaging heavy metals, then the membrane receptors function normally, and one of the membrane receptors is nitric oxide synthetase, and that's what makes nitric oxide. That got the Nobel Prize, I think, in 1988 for enhancing circulation, and that created all the Viagra, Cialis for male erectile function. But I can get that same benefit for my patients and my family members by just having them chelate, stop the damage to the membrane, and all their microcirculation improves. So it's just a wonderful thing to do in our 21st century, because I like metals in the sense that I have a cell phone, I have batteries, you know, I use all the airplanes and the heavy metals and the JP-4 jet fuel. I don't want to backfire in a jet, but so I know that we need to use metals, but I know how to detox so I can cohabitate with some of the toxic side effects.
Oh, well, I guess you start to Rita Ellithorpe, and of course we're going to be talking later about some of the means, of course, of helping the cell membranes, and that gets into the NT factor, but that'll be something we'll talk about in the next half hour. Rita, you'll go right ahead.
Well, yes, one of the other things is a physician today, if they understand their physiology, their chemistry, if they are really properly trained for medical school, they will understand that you have to get down to the cell membrane to improve a person's health. And the way you get down to the cell membrane is you have excellent circulation. And I can't tell you how many teenagers who come to me and I touch their feet and I squeeze their big toe and you can see my thumbprint, it's all white on their toe, and it takes 5 seconds for that toe to reflush back up to its pink state. If I'm 60 years old about, and when I squeeze on my big toe and my feet are warm, within 2 seconds, you know, I'm all reflushed. So here I could be their grandmother, and my microcirculation is better than theirs. So if I'm going to help their cell membranes and their brain membranes and their eye membranes and their vision and everything, I've got to have a capillary that reaches to that cell membrane. And once I get to the cell membrane, I have to restore what the membrane's made of. That membrane is made of fats and proteins. And these are special fats that we get from eating eggs, the yolk in particular, eating meat, eating fish, eating poultry. And so there's almost been a attack on eggs and meat as if this is going to harm you. And I agree, USDA tortured poor animals that are stalled and fed all this antibiotic and steroids and GMO corn. That's not the animal I'm talking about. I'm talking about grass-fed, wonderful sources because our cell membranes are made of it. And if you're going to get this from just eating pure vegetarian, it's going to be difficult. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I am not a vegetarian. I don't promote it because I find very few vegetarians past 7 years who do well. And my Indian patients who, for religious reasons, will not eat any animal product or even fish or poultry or eggs, they also, in America, are all becoming diabetic because to eat the source of cell membrane phospholipids, they have to eat a high, vegetarian diet, and that's largely carbohydrate. And none of these people here in America work as hard as the original Indians back in India. The hard work to burn off and keep in balance all the carbs that they had to eat to stay healthy. So we have a nutrient research program. We've done a tremendous amount of research on this, where we take phospholipids, the very fats that make up the cell membrane, and we put it into a nutrient, a multivitamin, a B vitamin, and, CoQ10, and we wrap these nutrients in these phospholipids, and we have tremendous benefit for cell membrane repair to help these vegetarians primarily. I see the biggest help for them. We have research where we have taken animals who have been fed this type of phospholipid food against a control group, and we watch these animals, these mice, after they're 2 or 3, months when they're old, they become old, we sacrifice them and we look at the brains, and we can actually see that their degree of DNA damage is almost minuscule. The DNA deletions are not what the control group who ate the standard grass food. We also do.
Well, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly this old adage that you are what you eat. Now, some people are vegetarians. They eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, and certainly we should eat lots of fruits and vegetables, but we need the animal fats. we need a good beef, and so much of the beef we have today is certainly made up of cows that are steers, cattle that are actually eating genetically modified corn, and then of course they're fattened up with IM shots or they're given aspartame so that they'll have lots of fat in them, because of course aspartame, NutraSweet, produces fat. But you really want to be, if you're eating meat, you want to be eating grass-fed beef that is not artificially fattened for slaughter. Basically, of course, eggs, however, there was a time, people said, oh, you don't want to eat eggs. That yellow cholesterol in the yolk, that's terrible for you. And that's just simply not true. You need meat. You need proteins. You need eggs. You need the fundamental things that certainly our grandfathers used to eat, and they were far healthier as a whole than we are. Why? Because our cell membranes are made up of fats, of lipids, and certainly those lipids are not only the cell membranes, they're the membranes around the mitochondria, which are little fragments within the cells, the batteries of the cells, that, of course, give us our energy. And if the mitochondria aren't working, we get chronic fatigue. But you pick up the story there, Dr. Ellithorp.
Well, indeed, we actually can see the laboratory evidence and the physical clinical expression of our patients improve. And our patients will have their sedimentation rates go from elevation, which reflects cell damage, down to way below the average accepted ranges. We see their hsCRPs go from inflamed cardiovascular indicators down to very low useful levels. We see their homocysteine levels drop from the high cardiovascular risk levels down to very low useful levels. We see their triglycerides drop, and these simple fats are just made from excess carbohydrates. When you eat more carbs than you need, your body will take that sugar, reassemble it into a simple fat called a triglyceride. And that is always the first evidence of damage, way before your cholesterol goes up. And when they lower their carbohydrate intake and they eat lower carb, low glycemic vegetables, then we start seeing their cholesterols drop. Without the addition of, you know, pharmaceuticals, lipid-lowering, cholesterol-lowering drugs. And we also know that there seems to be a direct link or a parallel between the start of using all this Lipitor cholesterol-lowering drugs and the onset of dementia and, Alzheimer-type behaviors mixed with the heavy metals and such. And we just see this basically as diabetes of the brain. They have created such a clogging of the teensy, teeny-weeny little capillaries. You have to understand, a capillary is only 1/200th of the diameter of a hair. That's pretty tiny. And if you don't drink enough water, and if you're eating a high fruit and vegetable that is high in starch diet, very minimal proteins, if any, and you're thinking that you're going to live a long life, you have to understand your capillaries are going to get clogged. You're going to have cold toes and feet, and you're going to have a sluggish mental cognitive function, and you're just going to be worn out. And we see these things turn around immediately, and we have the patients have better mentation, even vision. I've had patients who have optic neuritis. In this particular case, they've had autoimmune attack on the optic nerve. They get, you know, vision impairment, and then we look at their food allergies, eliminate them. We reduce their starches and fruits, sugars and carbohydrates. We hydrate them. We chelate them. We use cell membrane repair nutrients rich in phospholipids like NT factor, and voila, they get better. And it's just a joy to see patients satisfied, losing weight, thinking better, sleeping better, and just doing better all across the board and not getting sicker and sicker and getting on less and less medicines. This is a joy to be a doctor again.
Well, you know, more and more doctors are losing that joy of being a doctor because, of course, it's a whole different world today. Certainly, Dr. Ella Thorpe doesn't take Medicare. You don't take Medicare patients, do you?
Yes, I do. Oh,
you
yeah.
do take Medicare. Yeah. Okay, fine. Well, basically, of course, so money, much of what's going on today is regulated by the HMO, the various group practices, and they're basically, their government is telling doctors increasingly how to practice medicine. And they spend all their time doing paperwork rather than taking care of patients. We're going to be back here in just a moment, and we'll, of course, be talking about really the keys to health.
While the storm clouds gather, far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
Well, you go right ahead, Dr. Ella Thorpe.
One of the things I wanted to point out is many people think that you can eat as many fruits and vegetables as you want, that it's a good thing. I have to spend a lot of time re-educating my patients. I see maybe 6 to 8 people a day, and the good Lord still lets me pay my bills. But what I teach them is, if I do their fasting blood sugar and it comes out 94, all the labs are going to say you're in the normal range still. But I criticize that because back in 1970s when I was in medical school, I was taught by my physician mentor that he wanted all his patients worked up for diabetes if their fasting blood sugar was 94. I also get an insulin, a fasting insulin. When I get the insulin, the range on the insulin is anywhere from 3 to 25. Now, that's a stupid range. The insulin should be on the 25 end or it should be on the low end. Most people are in the teens. And so I asked them, were you really fasting? Oh, yes, Dr. Ellithorpe, I didn't eat anything for 12 hours before I took this blood test. And I said, then you're in danger because your blood sugars are in the 90s and your insulin fasting is in the teens. That means your body is so terrified of you taking in carbs and fruit sugars all the time that your pancreas is pumping out a reserve excess amount of insulin, fearful of what's going to come down your throat any minute. And I teach them, if I went to one of the missionary trips I was on, when we draw the blood of a person who lives in the outback and they don't have cars or stores or anything, they totally live primitively, they wake up with a fasting blood sugar in the range of 50. Normal physiology teaches us that when a person eats, they normally will double their fasting blood sugar. So these primitive people who don't have cancer, don't have heart disease, don't have diabetes, don't have obesity, don't have arthritis, don't have Alzheimer's, don't have depression, their blood sugar will go from 50 to 100. So throughout the day, when they eat and nibble, they will flap from 50 to 100.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Dr. Ellithorpe's been out and gone into the very primitive areas and notices certainly that the people in the very primitive areas don't have high blood pressure. They don't get the cancer. They don't get all the diseases that we get here in civilized society, and part of that, of course, is related to their diet, and basically they have a much lower blood sugar, and only when they're eating does their blood sugar get up to 80 or 90. But the people who do not eat as we do are far healthier. Now, basically, Dr. Ellithorpe, before we go on, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, get your website. I'd like you to tell them a little bit about NT Factor. And of course, this is put out by the people who put out ProPax. It is a combination of vitamins. But the most important thing is the NT Factor. What is this? Well, this is, of course, a lipid that helps to replace the lipid of the cell membranes and the membrane around the mitochondria. And of course, I will have to admit that we do advertise for that if you listen to our program. times why they usually will have an advertisement there talking about the NT factor, but you go right ahead.
Well, the NT factor stands for Nutritional Therapeutics. That's the name of a company in Halpag, New Jersey. We pray for their recovery because their place was somewhat challenged and damaged from the Sandy hurricane. But they are the ones who brought us in the late 90s this wonderful phosphoglycolipid that replaces the injuries to our cell membranes, whether it's your brain cell down to your toe cell. Every cell in your body is made up of this bilipid layer. And this has been studied in research, in preclinical and animal studies, and in vivo and in clinical situations. I'm published in this several times, primarily showing that by using this, we can actually demonstrate ATP production. The energy molecule of the cell, adenosine triphosphate, is enhanced in production, even to the point we were able to take elderly people and put them on this, compare them with a control group of young men, and the energy produced after 3 months on this was equivalent, after 30 days was equivalent to that of a 29-year-old man. And so we publish on fatigue reduction, and we can prove that the mitochondria functions better. We create the insulation back around the mitochondrial membranes made of the same membranes that the outer membrane and the nuclear membrane is made of. And this is why I attribute my health. I have fantastic energy. I work incessantly. I never take a vacation. And I love my work. I love seeing my patients and how they come back healthier and on less medicines. So NT factor in the form of Propax, the multivitamin, we can actually get better outcomes with modestly dosed nutrients so that even oncologists have looked at this and studied this at UCLA for patients undergoing chemotherapy. And they suffer tremendous cell damage from the chemotherapeutic agents. But when we did this as a double-blind crossover placebo control, one of Blalock's studies, I think that was Dr. Jerome Block. I can't remember which anymore. There's so many studies on this. The patients who had the NT factor in the form of this multi-mineral vitamin modestly dosed during chemotherapy did not suffer the degree of, nausea and fatigue and being worn out. And then when the crossover occurred, because the clinicians and the patients didn't know which was which, then they started to immediately decline. But what was so amazing was those that were never getting it, they were getting placebo. Once they got it on the crossover and they were already down with their fatigue and worn out and tiredness of their chemotherapy, they started pulling up in their energy. So I have seen this nutrient formulation for all the vitamins. We wrap it with CoQ10. We wrap it around the B vitamins. We wrap it around multivitamins and calcium, magnesium supplements. And I have never seen anything work or have as much research published on it as I have with the NT factor. It's just really incredible and well-documented.
Well, I think it's a great, great factor, and certainly I'm very, very pleased with certainly the results that we have seen with the use of the NT factor. And, of course, it's something that our friend Dr. Garth Nicholson certainly advocates. But go right ahead.
Well, we start our patients, on a holistic program. We start from their birth and their whereabouts and their childhood and their teens and their 20s and 30s, and, we get their real history. And then we do a study on their blood type and their digestion and their antioxidants and their toxins, and we look at their medicines they're on, and we look at their problems, their disease names, and then we set up this whole protocol to try and help them, and they really, really do well as a whole. I just don't have the degree of new heart attacks, new stroke, new blood clots. I just don't have the prevalence that's out there in the general population. It's really wonderful.
Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment for Dr. Ellithorp, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. But I think it's vitally important that people understand that basically, of course, Dr. Ella Thorpe is talking about several very important things. One, of course, is the fact that most people are poisoned by metals. And if you don't get rid of those metals, they're going to just continue plaguing you, alter your immune system, and certainly alter your cell metabolism. But the other thing, of course, is the importance of a proper diet. And of course, you certainly need not only vitamins and minerals, there are certain things that most of us are deficient in as far as minerals are concerned, like most people are deficient in magnesium, but certainly eating the right sort of thing, and then you need something to actually rebuild the cell membranes and the membranes around the mitochondria. And that's what this NT factor is about, isn't it?
Right, right. And I think one of the reasons why physicians are so depressed is from the get-go, when I was even back in the 70s in medical school, they kept on telling me, what are you going to specialize in? What are you going to specialize in? And I said, I want to be a doctor. I want to know everything, you know, and I want anything that walks through my door, I want to be able to help. And if I can't figure it out, I know my resources, some specialists I can get help from. The vast majority, 98% of everyone in my class went on to specialties and then subspecialties, as if you could only know a certain tiny pathway. And I think that's why we don't have doctors today who know these things or are able to take a whole person from birth to their current age, look at their entirety. Not that I know everything, but I really, you know, at almost 60 and doing this 33 years, I really understand that you have to have a sequencing, a pattern to take a whole person through this process. You can't have money as your objective. You have to have outcome. And then word of mouth, they'll be happy. They'll have their family come, and you'll just have income. You know, I'm not going to be wealthy, but I'm going to be happy. So if we don't teach this to doctors, you're going to have doctors with narrow focuses, limited abilities, and dependent upon a system, you know, only if John Hopkins says this is right, or only if the NIH says this is right. What about the fact that we're seeing the people all over the nation, and we see things that work, and they don't encourage doctors to learn how to publish, how to do studies, and report their stuff. They just want them to be little minions that do what high pinnacle pharmaceutical imaging studies and surgical interventions will do. Where I figured out how to start publishing, and I want to encourage my fellow colleagues and physicians that they can learn this, and it's fun. I'm running a study right now on fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. We're looking at certain nutrients that are known to help increase NK cells. These cells are the ones that are very powerful in attacking, you know, virus-type material, cancer cells, and we do see a strong correlation that those with chronic fatigue have low counts. So how fun is it for me to go to work watching a study or two every year get cranked out of my little tiny clinic and get it published? I feel wonderful, you know?
Well, basically, of course, what we're really talking about is the fact that there are millions of Americans who have chronic fatigue, and they have a great deal of difficulty getting better health. And now, chronic fatigue sort of merges in with fibromyalgia, with Lyme disease, certainly with Gulf War illness, and all of these certainly are related to the problems, certainly, of a poor immune system that's not working right, and one or a number of chronic infections. Would that be a fair appraisal of that?
Absolutely. I actually, when a patient comes in, I actually see them as cell membranes with a bunch of bruises and rashes on their cell membranes. And I get excited about trying to fix it. Because if I fix their cell membranes and their circulation, their body knows how to do the work to fight the virus, to fight the Lymes and stuff. And yes, I'll use tailored antibiotics when necessary. Yes, I'll get imaging studies when I need to. You know, yes, I'll use a consultant when I need to. But they're never going to get healed or a better immune system on steroids. You know, they're never going to be solved with just you know, a pharmaceutical, what about the whole concept of curing their high blood pressure?
Well, you know, the thing is that cortisone and steroids make people feel better, but they don't get to the cause of the disease. This is the thing. Now, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464 if you have a question. But right now, let's go to Lynn, who's calling us from Maryland. Lynn, are you there? Oh, I guess we lost
her. I am.
Okay. Okay, fine. Well, we're having a couple of people calling in, and let's see. I think we have Willie calling in. The board is lighting up, but the people keep lighting up and then disappearing. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you are out there and you have a question or comment, I will be right with you. Well, let's see. We seem to have lost Lynn from Maryland. Lynn, are you by any let's see. Who do we have on the line? Who is on the line?
I'm waiting for your wife.
All right, fine. Then we'll put you back up there so you can wait for my wife. And we have, who do we have on this line?
Hi, Dr. Stan. This is Lynn in Maryland.
Okay, fine, Lynn. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm so glad that I got back through. Thank you. I came on and I was listening to your interview with Dr. Ellithorpe.
Ellithorpe. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. I actually 2.5 years ago had a a week-long really high exposure to all kinds of solvent chemicals, and that was after 3 years of horrid chronic fatigue since I went to work in the building where I worked, and it turns out 7 other people have died. But I haven't really had any treatment all this time, and I had cognitive damage from it and lung damage.
Well, Lynn, what was wrong with the building?
It has, they teach photography classes on the first floor, and they shut off all the fresh air to the building in a heat wave.
It has what on the first floor?
I worked at a college, and they teach photography courses that always reek to chemicals.
Okay, fine.
But for the 2 or 3 weeks that this happened, somebody shut off all the fresh air to the building, and it's already a very poorly ventilated building.
Okay, so basically you have some sort of a toxic condition. So did you have a question for our guest?
I do. I'm wondering, I know that Dr. Ellithorpe said that she actually treats patients, but I don't know where she is. I'm assuming it's not my area because I haven't heard of her, but I'm wondering.
She's in Southern California.
Yeah, well, that would be a long way, considering if I go around anybody, I get sick. But I'm wondering what type of things would be useful to try to detox from this, because it's destroyed my life.
Well, I would, if you were seeing me, and if you call the American College for the Advancement of Medicine, ACAM, go to acam.com. You will see some physicians who are members of ACAM. I don't know them individually. I can't speak for them, but these are physicians who are becoming more and more interested in looking at chelation therapies and other nutraceutical and natural ways of healing you. So you might find someone in your local area. I am on the board of that organization. But basically, you have to understand your cell membranes are injured. You have to get a capillary to them. That's like getting a fire ladder to a house on fire. And that's chelation therapy. That would be one thing that I would do. And I would do high-dose vitamin C as a very immediate, quick antioxidant flushing. I would probably put you on N-acetylcysteine, which is a liver detox, maybe even lipoic acid. But I would be doing a antioxidant assay on you to see how much of your natural antioxidant and detoxification pathways had been disrupted. I would find out your blood type, and I would look at your food and digestion and make sure that you don't eat a high-carb diet that would clog up those tiny capillaries. I'd make sure that you drink plenty of water so that you could flush out these toxins as you urinate. And then I would give you the NT factor in the form of Propect as a multivitamin. I probably would give you trace minerals And I would give you enzymes, especially if you're blood type A or if you're above 60 years old, to help you digest your food, and systemic enzymes on an empty stomach twice a day to help reduce inflammatory and damaged cells. So at one fell swoop, we're addressing many problems, both the damaged cell, both the capillary to reach that cell with repair material and to take away debris, and teach you how not to clog up your capillaries and how to stay well hydrated, maybe even consider some natural hormone therapies, and then some tailored nutraceuticals as, you know, dictated by your toxin evaluation on a challenge with chelation EDTA and the red blood cell mineral studies and your stool studies. That's how I would approach it.
Okay, Lynn, we're going to have to let you go because we are out of time. But if you'd like to get hold of Dr. Ella Thorpe, just look her up on the Internet. You'll find her website and go there. It's fascinating. Okay.
All right, thank you both so very much.
Let's go to Willie calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Simpson. Willie, how are you doing?
Hey, Dr. Finn, I ain't talked to you since about 6 months ago down there.
Sure do. Remember that? Do you have a quick question for our guest?
Yeah, I got diabetes. What you recommend for me?
All right, fine. Well, you're going to have to hang on here. We're going to a break.
Okay.
And Sydney, I hear something in the background. Do you have a radio on, Willie?
Oh, wait, yes. I got your speakerphone. I think I'm speaking.
Okay, you turn that off.
How about that?
That's ever so much better. You hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoy the program with Dr. Ella Thorpe. But you must understand, we are what we eat, and because we've been poisoned, chronically poisoned, we've got to take care of that as well. Well, Rita, Sydney, Willie is saying he's got diabetes. What can you do that would actually help him?
Well, Willie, are you on insulin, or are you on oral medicines, or neither?
Metformin, 1,000 milligrams twice a day.
You take what?
Metformin.
Oh, metformin. Okay, so you're not on insulin.
No.
When I see my patients, I do a C-peptide to see what the amount of insulin that you can still generate, your fasting insulin, your fasting blood sugars, and your triglycerides. Now, I put all my diabetic patients on a low-carb diet, which means I insist that whatever dinner is, you make enough dinner so you can make up a breakfast plate and a lunch plate. So if you're having grass-fed beef tonight and green beans, which are very low-carb vegetables, and let's say spinach, then you're going to have 10 grams of carbs in the green beans and the spinach with your steak. And then you make three times that amount, so you have the same thing for breakfast and for dinner. So if you multiply all the carbs up, because there's no carbs in steak or chicken or fish or, you know, turkey or anything like that, or eggs, you would have only had a 30-carb amount of sugars to process. And then the next dinner, you would cook up, let's say, chicken, and you would have two different vegetables. Let's say the next day you would have Brussels sprouts and asparagus, and you would make enough so that you could set up a breakfast plate and a lunch plate. Once again, then you would know exactly how many carbs you have, because asparagus, about six spears would be about five carbs, and the Brussels sprouts would be another five, again, 30 carbs a day. So if you stayed in the range of 25 to 50 grams of carbs a day, you marched in place 7 minutes every day. You drank half your weight in water. So if you're a 200-pound man, you would drink 100 ounces of water. And then if you would take systemic enzymes, you know, like Wobenzyme or Vitalzyme, take about five twice a day on an empty stomach. That'll help open up your capillaries. And if you can find an ACAM physician, acam.com, acam.com, and get some chelation therapy to improve your microcirculation, because all diabetics start having clogged capillaries from their brains to their eyes to their toes. This will help open it up.
We're going to have to interrupt you there. We're out of time. Willie, I hope that will help you.
She gave me a lot of information.
God bless. Thanks very much. And Dr. Ellisthorpe, thank you so very much for being with us.
It was a pleasure. God bless.
God bless you. And we'll be talking to Dr. Ellisthorpe again, hopefully in the not-too-distant future. But I think this information is vitally important for people out across America. Well, this is Dr. Stan. This is the time when I really need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. If you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. Certainly, we have to get by radio time on stations across America. This evening program is going to be heard on probably about 11 or 12 stations at least. And, of course, we have all the electronic gadgetry. You can hear us on iPod and iPhone, on the Internet, and on the Apple TV. And you need to know all the various means that you can listen to us on. Why, certainly go to our website at radioliberty.com. But, Sydney, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family and help us get this information out across America, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get a book by Dr. Russell Blaylock. It's called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. We have a four-tape set with Dr. Blaylock called Life-Saving Secrets. Well, we have certainly the information on four-tape sets on mercury. We have an excellent book on magnesium. Most people are deficient on magnesium and should be taking magnesium. We have a list of health products that we carry. You can find them on our website, or you can call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Just ask for a list of the health products, because these are the things that my wife and I take. And as you know, I'm 83 and doing fairly well. My wife is, she's not supposed to tell how old a woman is, but you'd never have any idea how old she is by simply looking at her. She looks much younger than many people who are far younger than she is. But we can tell you that I believe these health products are beneficial, and that you should have them on hand. Certainly, we're moving into a difficult time. You should go ahead and certainly lay in a supply of food, of medical supplies. So you should have a big Berkey or water filtration facilities. Certainly, you need to be preparing for what I believe are really tragic times that lie ahead. Certainly, today, the United States, 40 cents out of every dollar that the government spends, 40 cents out of every dollar the government spends, they have to borrow. We're living on borrowed money. This whole system is coming down. It's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when. And I fear we're going to see terrible things happening next year. We're going to see rising inflation. We're going to see rising deficits. Our real deficit, according to John Williams at shadowstats.com, is certainly well over $80 trillion. It will never be repaid. The whole monetary system is going to collapse, and with that will come poverty for the vast majority of the people. So listen to our programs, begin making your preparations. We're not going to be able to head this off. Of course, what we need to understand is we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men, and God is going to bring his judgment on this nation. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to hear my talk on the dark secret and on the forbidden secret, and the syllabuses go with that. But if you're only going to get one item besides my book, you need to get Agenda 21, the covert plan. There's a syllabus with that, Jet. You don't have to get the syllabus. You can get it at a reduced cost, but it will give you the documentation what the people on the other side say. They're very straightforward. They admit what they're up to. They just figure that you will never understand it. If you want to hear people talking, somebody writing about the secret cabal that controls the world, the book is Memoirs by David Rockefeller, page 405, where he tells you he's part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States. And then he goes on to say, but look what a great job we're doing throughout the rest of the world, as we're raising the living standards of people all throughout the world. The book, Memoirs, they're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website, radioliberty.com. There on the Internet, you can listen to us 24 hours a day. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, our ministers, and Alex Jones and Joyce Riley and Noah Hutsings and John Leffler, but please pray for Radio Liberty. In a
from the mountain, through the prairie, through the ocean, white with gold. God bless America, my heart beats for. God bless America.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, hopefully they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who certainly was the former editor of the New American Magazine. He was at one time the managing editor of the Republic Magazine. He's certainly written a number of books, which tragically most of them are out of print at the present time, but I commend them to you. They're well worthwhile reading. And then, of course, at the present time, William writes the newsletter, the monthly newsletter for Radio Liberty. So you can read his writings, and I'll tell you, the October newsletter he just finished writing is a classic. You'll certainly want to read it, you want to think about it, you want to contemplate it, and understand that we are having real problems in America because we've lost the dream that one time made America the envy of the world. And that was that the fact we were to live in a nation where men were to be free, where the power of the central government was to be limited by the chains of the Constitution, because the people who founded America realized, of course, that men are basically corrupt, and power corrupts absolutely everyone. Power corrupts absolutely everyone. And so they didn't want to have a government that had power, because they knew that power would be misused down the line. And so when they established the Constitution, there were only a very, very few things the federal government could do. But what most people do not understand is that when America was established, there was a small group of occultists here in America, and they wanted to use America to one day bring about a one-world government. The only way they could do that, of course, was to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., and then, of course, use that power to raise funds so they could use that money to the financial and military power of the United States to bring about a one-world government. And you must understand that this is exactly what's going on today. Why do you think it is that the United States has troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world today? Why does the United States have over 40,000 troops stationed in Germany? I mean, who are they there to defend? Why does the United States have over 30,000 troops stationed in Japan? You know, it's almost 60 years after, over 60 years after World War II ended. Why does the United States have over 20,000 troops stationed in South Korea? When, through the years, if you go back and read history, you'll find that time and time again, the United States has actually helped to fund North Korea. And of course, they promise not to build a bomb, and so we give them a lot of money, or we give them oil, or we give them, build a nuclear power plant for them, and then, of course, they start building a bomb again, and then we take it away. And we've done this time and time and time again. We've funded North Korea since it was established, and we've funded communism in China since it was established. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it to find out how we funded people, powerful people, part of what I call the Brotherhood, funded Lenin, Io, and Stalin, initially, and then, of course, they funded the Nazis, and today they're funding the terrorists and Al-Qaeda. We have to have an enemy in preparation for the coming war. And unless you understand that there's this small group of very evil people who control our government, it is not simply by accident that between 1997 and the year 2008, every president and or every vice president of the United States came from the membership list of the Trilateral Commission. You can go to augustreview.org and verify that. We'll be back in just a moment.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer, God bless America.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and right now we don't have our regularly scheduled guest, William Grigg. So if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, don't be bashful. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and we'll be glad to talk about whatever you would like to talk about. But before we went to the break, I was simply pointing out that there was a small group of people who many years ago set out to take control of America so that they could circumvent the will of the founding fathers, the Christians who founded this country, and basically go right ahead and establish a one world government. They wanted to use the financial and military power of the United States to bring about this one world government, and they are in totally control today. As I pointed out before the break, why, of course, between 1977 and the year 2008, every president and or vice president of the United States was a member, certainly, of the Trilateral Commission, and you can go to augustreview.org. AugustReview.org, that's Pat Wood's website, and document what I'm saying. Certainly, six of the eight representatives, American representatives to the World Trade Organization, came from the membership roles of the Trilateral Commission. Certainly, seven of the 12 secretaries of state, nine of the 12 secretaries of defense during that period between 77 and 2008, 1977 and 2008, they all came from the membership roles of the Trilateral Commission. Ladies and gentlemen, there's never been more than 87 members of the North American chapter, and that includes both Canada and Mexico, as well as the Americans. Understand, we have an elite who runs America, and they have a presidential election every 4 years, and their candidates run. And basically, when Barack Obama became the president of the United States, 11 of his closest advisors and people on his cabinet, his national security advisors, State Department, and the Treasury Department, 11 of his closest advisors came from the membership roles of the Trilateral Commission. Do you really believe that was happened by accident? If you do, you're incredibly naive. And certainly this was true before him, with certainly George Bush and with Bill Clinton, yes, and with George Herbert Walker Bush, and with Ronald Reagan, yes, even Ronald Reagan had 270 members of the CFR and the Trilateral Commission in his administration, because, of course, after he had his assassinated attempt, they tried to kill him, and the assassin just happened to be the son of a very close friend of George Herbert Walker Bush. What are the chances that that would happen? After that, why Ronald Reagan was very much circumspect in what he did to oppose the establishment. We've got William on the line right now. Hi, William. How are you doing?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing very well. I appreciate your patience this evening. I had a last-minute phone call I had to take, but it's a blessing to be with you as always.
Well, what are we going to talk about this evening?
When you're talking about this elite, this entrenched elite that is clustered around the Council on Foreign Relations and some of these other sort of semi-occultic groups, by occultic I mean hidden, their intentions are never made very transparent to us, and most of the deliberations take place out of the public eye and out of the range of cameras and so forth. They're always looking to consolidate power. They're always looking to exploit tragedies, catastrophes, crises. They want to create order out of chaos. And, of course, this can include scenarios like the one that we see unfolding right now in the northeast of the United States in the aftermath of what is called the megastorm Sandy, which in historical terms is a big storm, but it's by no means the biggest. It's by no means the most powerful. This is not an unprecedented disaster in terms of the impact of nature on human habitations and commerce and infrastructure. But what we're seeing is the unraveling of civil order, civil society, that is to say the spontaneous result of interaction among reasonably free people in New York City, particularly in some of the outlying boroughs. Staten Island is becoming downright Hobbesian from everything that I've been able to read and understand about this. And you have the political elite, as is usually the case, posing for cameras and congratulating each other, congratulating themselves on their insight and their boldness and their intrepidity, while you see the spectacle of people defecating in high-rises and people diving in dumpsters and rummaging for food and the spoiled refuse that's been thrown out by some of the convenience stores and grocery stores in what would be considered, I guess, sort of the showpiece or showcase city of the United States. And this is because you had a storm that is, as Carl Denninger pointed out — Carl Denninger is a Wall Street analyst and economic pundit — he pointed out that a hurricane is one of the most avoidable catastrophes. If you have advance warning of several days, and you have some detailed information as to where landfall is expected to occur and when it's expected to occur, then if you're choosing to stay behind, the only rational assumption here is that you have made preparations to withstand the storm. If you stay behind, chances are things are going to get really ugly. If you have the means to get out, you should get out. There's a piece, a commentary by a New York City resident that talks about the fact that you've got a very severely stratified economic system in New York. The pundit's name is, I don't have that in front of me. I'll find it in a second here. But this gentleman lives in New York, and he spent the last several days examining how this severely stratified economic system in New York City has resulted where you have a whole army of people who are generally immigrants, but also people in middle age who are blue-collar workers. They're people who are waitresses, service people, utility people, and so forth. They're tethered to jobs, and they really don't have the luxury of simply pulling up stakes and moving when they're confronted with this type of a scenario. You know, the domestics, the people who are involved in shelving and stocking grocery stores, people who are service station attendants, people of that sort, they, of course, are sort of the receiving end of the brunt of this whole thing, whereas people who have more mobility, people among the elite, have been able to take care of themselves quite a bit better. And that's not necessarily an indictment of capitalism, but that is an illustration of how precarious our system has become. You've got this stratification that's taken place because of the way the system has been rigged. You've got people who don't really have the means to prepare themselves for situations of this sort, and other people who are redundantly blessed with the means to do so. And the people at the top of that pyramid tend to be those who cluster around the government-sponsored corporate and investment entities that have been the recipients of all this largesse the Federal Reserve has been pumping out for many decades, but in manic fashion since 2008. And you have the situation where the people who are the working class, the poor, working poor, you know, people who are generally looked upon as sort of doing the scut work and the grunt work of our economy, they're below the so-called plimsoll line. The plimsoll line on the ship, of course, was that level where the ship had to reach a certain buoyancy, and if you're below the plimsoll line and the ship got hit, then chances are you're going to be among the first to die. I mean, when the Titanic hit an iceberg, the people in steerage were the first to die. And there was a little bit more nobility among the upper classes on that ship, the Astor and so forth. They actually comported themselves with a great deal more nobility and a sense of responsibility, noblesse oblige, than you'd see today, of course, in our increasingly vulgar and deracinated culture. But if you have the means to get out, you've got advance warning to get out, you've made some kind of preparations to deal with this type of contingency, then you'll be far better off than the people who are stranded on Staten Island right now without food or water. In many instances, they're left without electricity, and they won't have electricity for the next several days. You've got elderly people who are facing the prospect of death through exposure and dehydration. You've got people like Charles Schumer who are spawning about trying to get FaceTime, showing conspicuous displays of photogenic compassion for people, and being screamed at because the political class is not following through on the implicit promise that they would take care of people at all times and all hazards. And that's a useful corrective, I think, but it's a very painfully taught lesson. The government is not going to protect you. The government is not going to come to your aid. The New York Times and other organs of the prestige press are tub-thumping right now for the proposition that this disaster illustrates the need for big government. Well, big government is failing, and big government has failed. One of the reasons why this storm has been so severe in terms of its impact, first of all, is the fact that the municipal political class, the corporatist class in New York, have insisted on using taxpayer dollars to build up exposed areas along the shoreline through various state-chartered corporations that reclaim landfills and then build industrial and commercial buildings in a very exposed and dangerous place. One of the reasons they're able to do this is because of the Federal Flood Insurance Program, which is administered by, guess which agency? FEMA. Just in June of this year, Mr. Obama signed into law, I guess you have to call it law, expansion of the Flood Insurance Program that is a subsidy for that type of, I would consider to be, municipal or civic misfeasance on the part of planning agencies, that they would be building these critical structures in such exposed and vulnerable positions geographically. But one of the reasons they're able to do that is because taxpayers across the country pick up the expense of insuring them against 100-year floods and other acts of God of the sort that we just saw. that's big government in action, creating or helping to facilitate the conditions that bring about a crisis that it will now exploit in order to aggrandize its powers even further.
Well, the only tragic thing is the government doesn't have the money to do it. With 40 cents out of every dollar the government spent having to be borrowed, one of these times we're going to have a big storm, and then when they come to collect their money, there's not going to be any there. Of course, they can always create it out of nothing. But they're doing that now with quantitative easing 1, 2, 3, and we'll soon have quantitative easing 4, I suspect. And, of course, very soon we destroy the value of the currency. Then, of course, we destroy the stability of our nation as well. We'll be right back. William, you go right ahead.
As the classic torch song jazz ballad said, here's that rainy day. You know that a rainy day is going to come sometime. You're supposed to be preparing for it. The wise man, of course, builds his house on the rock. The foolish man builds his house on sand. We're all told in the same vein that it's necessary to start putting things away for a rainy day. When you're experiencing the 7 years of plenty, you have to keep in mind the 7 years of famine. All these anecdotes, parables, figures of speech have to do with the idea of preparing and having a time preference that is more long-term rather than the type of immediate-term gratification, high-time preference orientation that most people have. We live in the definitive high-time preference society. I don't think there's ever been one to compare with the United States. Of course, high time preference means that you will want to spend now and borrow if necessary, and you defer responsibility for your current consumption. That's how we've been living, of course, intermittently since the founding of our country. We're just like everybody else. Human beings, of course, are creatures of appetites. We indulge our appetites willingly, and only with great grudging reluctance do we impose discipline on them. But since 1913, during the last century, because of the existence of this dreadful institution called the Federal Reserve, we have been sort of re-engineered into a society that is entirely defined by high time preference. If you're somebody who is a prepper, and it's interesting how that has been an epithet this past year or so, the very concept of being preparedness-oriented, being somebody who, for instance, is taking in a supply of food and water and other necessities in the interest of being protected should we see some kind of cataclysmic event, whether political or man-made, or whether political or natural. During this last year, preppers have been sort of targeted as perhaps not merely deranged in some sense, but enemies of society because they're opting out of the high time preference covenant, if you will. They're taking what they have and they're saving it for their own use. Now, under the ethos that has been generated by our rulers, this is completely improper. You're supposed to be part of one great undifferentiated community, and the community will take care of you, which means that you cannot be so perversely individualistic as to be looking out for your own needs, those of your kith and kin, and perhaps your neighbors. It's gotten to the point where we've talked about how one individual identified as a prepper was forcibly disarmed by the state government after he was taken in for a medical check, and another fellow who was traveling to Japan, actually to Okinawa, to visit his wife, who was in the Navy, was taken off the airplane in Hawaii because his name had ended up on the no-fly list, primarily because he was such a conspicuous exponent of the preparedness lifestyle. And now we see, just within a couple of weeks of that second incident, the horrible consequences of not having a prep-oriented lifestyle, the consequences of living in the proverbial city that never sleeps, the city of instant gratifications of practically every impulse, whether it's noble or gross, and you have people now who are dying in horrible ways that are more appropriate to the milieu of a third-world culture than what you would expect to see in the most opulent and, I guess, by some measures at least, the wealthiest city in the United States. You know, here is that proverbial rainy day. So, Dr. Stan, when you talk about the fact that at some point some storm will hit, some earthquake will rage, some cataclysm will befall us.
And hold that thought, William. We'll be back in just a moment here. And William is simply talking about this whole idea of being prepared for a difficult time. And certainly there's a Staten Island there in New York. Why, of course, the people weren't prepared, as some of the people were evacuated, others stayed behind. There's looting going on, a total chaos. And of course, a lot of places there's no food. People are having going to dumpsters to try to get food. There's no water. Certainly, many places there, they just got their power back on today, and other areas where they're going to be without power for many days more. And of course, William is saying that certainly people should begin preparing for difficult times, whether these would be certainly matters of man-made problems or acts of God, doesn't really matter. We need to be prepared for issues such as this, and yet today, the people who are preparing for a cataclysmic event many times are criticized. They're called preppers. And when they use that term prepper, why, it's always very derogatory. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, we really should be preparing for the difficult times, because I can assure you they are coming. Go right ahead, William.
They're here, as a matter of fact. And one of the things that you'd mentioned earlier, Dr. Stan, was the fact that the government that has extended these promises, both explicit and many more implicit promises of helping us, protecting us in emergencies, is borrowing most of what it spends from people in China and Japan and elsewhere, who at some point are probably going to want to collect something more worthwhile than the degraded, ever-depreciating IOUs that are issued by Washington. And what's happening, we're finding out right now, is that the only solution, the only tool that they have in the toolkit right now to deal with this catastrophe is the old standard of monetary inflation, where we have not just merely QEs 1 through 3 or QE infinity. In principle, QE 3 could go on for Zimbabwean length and reach trans-Weimarian proportions of hyperinflation. But just within the last couple of days, an official with, I believe, the Boston branch of the Federal Reserve said that inflation is good irrespective of the impact that it has on the economy, that inflation itself, that is to say that a deliberate debasement of the currency by the counterfeiting arm of the government that presumes to rule it, that's a good thing. That's a positive good in se, irrespective of its effects on the economy. So it wasn't even trying to say that the supposedly stimulative effect of inflation is good, that inflation itself is a good thing. There's been some discussion about the Federal Reserve targeting a tranche of monetary inflation at New York, New Jersey, some of the other places that have been hit by Sandy in the aftermath. That, of course, would be redundant, because most of what's happened since 2008 was to the benefit of the financial district in New York and, of course, the wealthier parts of New Jersey. And that goes back to what I said about the stratification here. I mean, it's almost, leaving aside, of course, the unfortunate economics of the author, it's almost Dickensian what you're seeing in New York right now, the fact that people who are in the maker class, and that would be the lower class, the middle class, the struggling middle class, the upper class, the people who are not politically favored, the people who are not politically connected, some of them are probably collecting transfer payments from the government in terms of welfare subsidies and things of that kind. It's almost ubiquitous. It's almost impossible to avoid that, irrespective of what part of the country you're living in. But they're not receiving huge outpourings of original debt, debt, that is to say, a debt-generated largesse from the Federal Reserve. They're not working with Goldman Sachs. They're not working with any of the other corporate remora that batten on the corporate the Goldman Sachs, the great white shark that is Goldman Sachs. You know, the people in Wall Street are far bigger welfare recipients than the people who are making, say, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year and supplementing themselves with food stamps and so forth. But the people that are getting the food stamps, of course, by EBT cards, electronic bank transfer cards, have found out that doesn't work now. You know, they can't take their EBT cards to go buy milk or water or bread or diapers or other necessities for their families, even if such things were available, which for the most part that they aren't. And so they're doubly condemned here. And at the same time, of course, you've got the upper class, which has been the recipient of all this huge redistribution of wealth through the Federal Reserve, who are doing a lot better than the ones at the bottom of the ladder. Now, the really tragic thing is that this This tragedy is most likely to convince people already inclined to believe that government is the omnipotent savior to embrace that with more tenacity rather than reevaluating the premise of the civil religion that we've been taught. And that would be, I think, just once again, a singular tragedy in American history. People didn't take the right lessons from this catastrophe and start making more intelligent choices.
Let me just point out that if you're out there in the listening audience, give serious thought to begin putting aside food, maybe just the staples, all you can afford. If you can afford the more luxurious freeze-dried, the dehydrated food, but you need water, you need medical supplies, and you need a means of purifying water like the Big Berkey. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that difficult times lie ahead.
Let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
Well, William, you were right ahead.
There's an interesting insight from Hurricane Katrina, and of course what made Hurricane Katrina so bad was when you had the flood subsequent to the actual hurricane. There's a sheriff by the name of Harry Lee, who was in one of the flood-ravaged areas, I believe, of Mississippi. And what he said is, if the federal government would have responded as quickly as Walmart, we could have saved more lives. There were plenty of instances where you had people of their own volition, of their own accord, using what means they had. Some very wealthy people, for instance, put together air fleets to fly in supplies to Mississippi and Louisiana. The NBA basketball player, Hall of Fame basketball player, Karl Malone, had a trucking company that moved in heavy equipment to help clear away a lot of the storm damage in Mississippi and Louisiana. He's from Louisiana originally. He was actually threatened with arrest by a federal functionary because he wasn't taking orders from FEMA. He said, go ahead and put the cuffs on me. I'm going to help these people. There's a case just in the last couple of days of a group of electricians from, I believe, Mississippi. I think it was from the Deep South. They went to New York. They tried to get into New York, but they were turned away because one of the politically connected unions there wouldn't allow them in because they're not union contractors. You've got people who are going to be dying because the power is off. You've got old people who are going to die from exposure, children who are going to die from exposure. You've got people who have been relocated from hospitals because the government-inspected generators failed, and they're not letting in electricians to help reestablish the power grid because of political considerations. That's lunacy, but it's typical of the political system we're talking about, and I would earnestly hope, I just passionately, desperately hope, that people will examine this rationally rather than falling for the standard and constantly reiterated line here that somehow there's this mystical function of government that can protect us and make everything better if we simply embrace the gospel of better living through coercion and plunder. It doesn't work that way, and it's not working that way. This is a huge failure of government, as is usually the case when a catastrophe strikes. A catastrophe, of course, reveals character. It reveals some of the things that we usually bury beneath multiple layers of self-flattering delusion. I mean, that's the sort of thing that happens during time.
I want you to hold that thought. Hold the thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William is talking about the catastrophe that we've seen back in New York and the fact that basically there have been other catastrophes, whether it be Hurricane Katrina or others, but when the federal government comes in, they do nothing but complicate it. And if you've ever studied what happened after Katrina, the government wasn't there to help. They were actually keeping help away, and basically there were people trying to get in with their boats so they could rescue the people who were on the roofs of the buildings, and the government government wouldn't let them in. Oh, no, we can't let you in with a motorboat there. And they were turning people away, and many people died because the government was there blocking the bringing in of food and supplies and rescue workers and medical supplies. Now, ladies and gentlemen, how could you be so stupid unintentionally? They had, of course, their black water thugs or mercenaries going door to door collecting weapons and forcing people out of their homes so they could be looted by looters there. People who were armed and sort of were comfortable and had food. The government interfered and they actually arrested people. And what was their crime? They wanted to stay in their home and guard it. Ladies and gentlemen, there's no problem facing America today. Certainly the government won't make worse because this is no longer our government. Our government has been taken over by what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. That is an entirely different agenda. It is working throughout the world, installing dictators, and certainly undermining legitimate governments. And whether you like necessarily the governments or not, we have undermined the government of Egypt, of Tunisia, of Libya. We're financing the rebels, the killers, the murderers there in Syria, the Al-Qaeda, the people who are fighting the government there of Syria. And, of course, we are backing the ruthless dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. Why are we backing the ruthless dictatorship in Saudi Arabia? And why are we working so closely with the leaders of communist China, which is a totalitarian dictatorship, and Russia, which, of course, has a facade of democracy, but is only a facade because, of course, they've rigged the elections there, just like they do here. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Will. That's really interesting. One of the side stories emerging here from the situation in the northeastern United States has to do with the proximity of next week's election and the fact that so many of the voting precincts now exist in areas of completely wrecked infrastructure, and you've got people who don't have the means to get where they need to go in order to cast votes. And so the military is showing up with trucks full of ballots. You can have the military administer the election. Now that, of course, is a situation that is pregnant with all kinds of mischief. But it reminds me quite a bit of what used to take place in Latin America when I was there back in the early 1980s. I was in Guatemala in 1982 and 1983, left in early January of 1984. And military rule in Guatemala was sort of sub rosa when I arrived. There's a fellow by the name of Efrain Rios Montt. He'd been a general. And as a general, he was, of course, a mass murderer. As a matter of fact, he's been hauled into the dock in recent years, put on trial for genocide. Genocide, in this case, defined as an ethnically specific targeted campaign against Indians, unassimilated Indians in Guatemala. But he was a CIA-installed puppet ruler of Guatemala, and then in early 1983, they decided that they'd yank him out. The CIA, having lifted into power, removed him from power, put him on a helicopter, and took him to an island somewhere. It's sort of like Napoleon being shipped off to Elba. But what happened with the military is that when they took over, they maintained sort of a pretense of normalcy, where you still had municipal elections, but you had to cast your ballot under the watchful eyes of people who were carrying M16 rifles. And you're going to have that sort of a spectacle now unfold in some parts of New York City here. You've got a situation where a lot of the early ballots that have been cast have been lost now. You've had the crash not only of the physical infrastructure, but a lot of the cyber infrastructure. A lot of the information is now permanently etherized. That's, of course, a huge festering problem that is latent with all kinds of really interesting implications if we end up with a very close election like most people believe. And I think that it's interesting as well that we're seeing the conversation about the catastrophe in New York and the ramifications of it. We're seeing that sort of accelerate and deepen the conflict here over the legitimacy of the voting process nationwide. You mentioned, Dr. Stan, that in Russia, post-Soviet Russia, as it's called, you have elections that are rigged. You also have the involvement of American officials working through the National Endowment for Democracy. Interesting organization, very briefly, just to give a thumbnail sketch description of it. The National Endowment for Democracy is about, I think, 20 years old. I think it'll be 20 years old in 1983. I can't remember the name of the fellow who is the founder and president of it, but he is an old Trotskyite. He's somebody who was part of the American Socialist Party before it changed its name. So he's somebody who's a Marxist in terms of his economic outlook and a Trotskyite in terms of his political outlook. And of course, Leon Trotsky was the founder of the Red Army. He believed in international and global revolution. He differed with Joseph Stalin on a couple of tactical matters. As a result, Mr. Trotsky ended up with an ice pick, ice axe, shoved into his skull in Mexico City in 1940 by an assassin of the hire of Joseph Stalin. But his disciples ended up infiltrating the Republican Party, beginning in the 1950s, to back Eisenhower, and today they're called the neocons. Well, the National Endowment for Democracy is the neocon Comintern. That's the entity they use in order to promote world revolution. And one of the things that they have done is that they have created two different groups within the National Endowment for Democracy. One's called the International Republican Institute, the other's called the National Democratic Institute. And both of those, of course, are attached to the respective branches of the incumbent party, the Republicans, the Democrats. The International Republican Institute is headed by John McCain. I can't remember the name of the person who heads up the National Democratic Institute, but somebody of like mind, somebody else from the stable of CFR, pseudo-statesmen and pseudo-scholars, no doubt. But the National Endowment for the Democracy, for the last 15, 16 years or so, or longer, has been sending election monitors into the former Soviet Union, into places like Ukraine and to the various stands. I believe that they've been active also in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, monitoring elections. Now, this is not something that the federal government of the United States has the constitutional authority to do. There's simply nowhere in the Constitution, and nowhere, quite frankly, in our laws, that we can find authorization for the United States federal government to be sending election monitors to other countries, whether you're talking about the former Soviet Union or Latin America. There are a lot of international observers from the United States that have been election observers in various countries. Well, this year, for, I'm thinking, the third time, the United States is going to play host, unwillingly, to election monitors from other countries, including the former Soviet Union, through the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE.
Now, basically, what you're talking about is, of course, they're going to send monitors in to monitor our elections to be sure they're honest. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But, of course, it really has nothing to do with it because, of course, the two major candidates have already been selected by the Trilateral Commission. They control both of them. So if you monitor this election, it really doesn't mean anything at all. It is all a facade. It is all to give this perception of that the American people are going to vote for their and choose their next ruler. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. The elite have chosen the rulers for us. There are two candidates, and we will go to the polls to throw the scoundrels out and bring in somebody who will support American ideals, whereas, of course, both candidates are certainly subject to the dictates of what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, in this instance, the Trilateral Commission. It is not simply by coincidence that when Barack Obama became president back in 2009, that he chose 11 of the 87 members of the Trilateral Commission. 11 of the 20 of the 87 members of the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission to be his closest advisors on his cabinet and his key national security advisor. Go right ahead.
That's exactly right. You're talking about the same stagnant Stygian pool of personalities, I guess you'd call it talent, that always ends up being dipped from to supply personnel for any administration, Republican or Democrat, because these two aggregations of political personalities are fungible. They're completely interchangeable with, of course, certain cosmetic differences that means they can play to different constituencies and keep everybody on that same reservation. And now you have these international shepherds, if you will, coming in through the OSCE, which is an affiliate of the United Nations system. That's a very important part of the story. Coming in as poll watchers, and good on Texas and Iowa and a couple of other places in the country, there have been some officials, such as the Attorney General for the state of Texas and the Secretary of State in Iowa, who have told the OSCE that we will not tolerate the presence of international observers within a protected radius, a protected area surrounding polling stations. In Texas, they've been warned that if they come within, I believe, 100 feet of a polling area, they're likely to be arrested.
But, of course, the internationalists are saying, look, you do not have the right to do that. Mm-hmm. This is agreed upon by international law. And, of course, what this is really all about, ladies and gentlemen, is an effort to establish that we have international laws that supersede the laws of the United States, that supersede the laws of the states, and that for all intents and purposes we have an international elite that rules us, and the average American has no idea. This has been the age-old plan of the ancient mystery religions and secret societies that are in complete and total control of both of our political parties at the upper echelons today. And the coming election is simply an exercise in, well, I can tell you who the Trilateral Commission wants and who is going to be elected on Monday, but I don't want to spoil things for you, so we'll discuss it on Monday when the election results come in, but I know who they're backing. Go right ahead.
One of the things about this, though, that I find really interesting is that the whole system, as you say, Dr. Steen, is scripted and choreographed, and so the introduction of this element, that is to say the international inspection of what's going on here, is, in my opinion, a very important way of trying to integrate more thoroughly America's political system into this global apparatus of control. It's not as if they're going to make a material difference in the outcome. Of course, if we had this huge controversy, something like what happened in Florida in 2000, then conceivably we could have a situation where if, say, Mr. Obama ends up losing a very closely contested election, he could actually appeal this to an international body. That would be a really interesting development. I can see that happen. I can see the same thing happening if you have Mr. Romney on the other side, on the short side of a very closely contested election. That's a very strong possibility as well. But we're seeing how we've been put to a position where we're losing the independence that is necessary in order to protect a system that shelters our individual rights.
But, of course, we saw that so clearly, you know, in the year 2000 when George Bush lost the election. But, of course, then the Supreme Court of Florida had said, you know, Al Gore won Florida, which meant that Al Gore was going to become the president. Mm-hmm. And then they appealed it to the United States Supreme Court. Now, there is no precedent for the United States Supreme Court telling states how to run their elections.
Exactly.
This is a state issue. It is done in the states. And if there is to be a question, it would be decided by the Supreme Court of the state of Florida. But, of course, now we've said, oh, no, the United States Supreme Court will make that decision. And after all, if the United States Supreme Court can make the decision, why not the world court?
Exactly.
Shouldn't we appeal to the ultimate authority? And the average American doesn't understand that this is all scripted, very, very specifically and intentionally. So that sovereignty as we've known it as a nation, freedom as we've known it as individuals, will simply become soon a remembrance of things past. Go right ahead, William.
I can see that happening very easily if you have in the upper part of the country, the northeastern states, you have a situation where people aren't able to vote or votes aren't able to be calculated correctly, or if you have a continued procession of glitches in Iowa, which is, of course, ground zero here for the conflict, I could see where you could end up generating a controversy that would appear to be headed to the Supreme Court, and then one side or another is going to say, no, we saw what happened last time the Supreme Court intervened. We need a neutral third party to intervene and arbitrate this matter.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is, of course, we have so many electronic voting machines, yet so much of the area back there in New York and the surrounding states will not have electricity to make the electronic voting machines work. Of course, we'd be far better off, in my estimation, simply with paper ballots that are marked and counted locally rather than electronic ones, because they're rigged. They can rig those machines. They have in the past. They're doing it today. But, of course, well, it's going to be so interesting to see how this develops on Monday. Go right ahead.
Yeah, interesting is one word for it. Potentially terrifying is another. And on top of this, we have to take into account the Homeland Security dimension of this. Of course, FEMA is part of the Homeland Security Department. Within a couple of weeks, or just a couple of weeks ago, actually it was October 26th, so it's less than 2 weeks ago, Mr. Obama signed an executive order creating an entity called the White House Homeland Security Partnership Council. I prefer to call it a Soviet because I think that's a more descriptive and appropriate term. This is going to be a coordinating body to subsume all the state Homeland Security departments into the federal apparatus. Guess who's going to be heading up this body? John Brennan. John Brennan is the chief intelligence advisor to the White House. He's the guy who holds the death list. He's the guy who presides over the secretive meetings of the Star Chamber Court that decides who's on a kill list and subject to execution by drone-fired missile or by more conventional death squad. That's the guy who's going to be in charge of this new Homeland Security Partnership Council. He's the guy making the so-called disposition matrix, that Orwellian term that describes this permanent apparatus of indefinite detention, summary execution, and so forth. So really, the only way you can make more obvious what this guy is going to do is if he were to change his last name from Brennan to Beria, because he's, as far as I can tell, going to be the first fully functioning interior minister or head of the secret police in American history. That's just happened within the last week or so. Don't tell me that they're not going to find some Homeland Security angle out of what's happened in the aftermath of Sandy to justify new enrichment of that power.
Let me just point out, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't think that they killed people in America, why, of course, we carry a book called New World Order and NWO Assassins. And it really goes into a lot of the people of political assassinations here in the United States. We have a four-tape set called Deadly Assassins, where I interview two government assassins. One was trained in Special Forces as a murderer. He was asked to murder a gentleman here in America who knew something about the Kennedy assassination. The other, of course, was a CIA-trained assassin. His job was to kill a presidential candidate, and he didn't kill that candidate. You may very well remember the election back in 1988, where there were three people running for office. One was a man named Ross Perot, and he dropped out. He dropped out of the election because he said that he and his family were in danger, and then he came back in later. Well, oh, you will actually hear the man, the interview with a man, who had a contract on Ross Perot. This is not imaginary. Lieutenant Colonel Marvin is dead now, and certainly Chip Tatum, the other assassin, we don't know what happened to him. We've heard he was living on an island in the Caribbean, and, well, he may or may not be there today. We'll be back in a moment. Go right ahead, William. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, as always, it's a real blessing to be with you, and I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate, once again, your patience this evening, given that there was a slight divot taken out of our time this evening when I had an unexpected phone call that I had to take. We're dealing, of course, as you like to say, with world historic events. We're living in a period of time that's going to become increasingly cluttered with breathtaking developments. Some of them are going to be inspiring and perhaps a source of great comfort and inspiration. Some of them, more of them, I contend, are going to be of the trials variety. They're going to be the sort of events that limb the depths of our souls and then assay what exists in our souls and will be, of course, measured and tested in ways that we haven't been as a country, I think, for a long, long time, if ever. And I appreciate the fact, Dr. Stan, you constantly reiterate the necessity for people to make physical preparations for the times that are unfolding before us. This event in New York and New Jersey and surrounding states is such a mind-bendingly awful development to see this sort of thing happen in what had been, once again, sort of the marquee area of the Eastern Seaboard, the showpiece area of the Eastern Seaboard, America's leading city in many ways. Of course, you had September 11th in 2001, that had the same kind of psychic impact. In this case, it's even scarier because this is a proverbial act of God. And the way that we deal with chastening developments of this sort is going to define what our life is going to be like in the next phase of our existence as a country. If they take the right lessons here about eschewing cultivated dependence on the elite that rules us and acting as principled individuals, making intelligent choices, making sound preparations, and becoming more spiritually attuned to what our Creator intends us to do. We make those choices, and we'll be able to surmount the tests that are coming. And I earnestly hope that we'll be able to make those intelligent choices, and we'll humble ourselves in the appropriate ways to where we can prepare ourselves for what's coming.
Well, I certainly do as well. And, of course, our guest this evening has been certainly William Grigg. And, William, I want you to stay on just a moment or two more till we can bring all of our stations back on board. And then, of course, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website and how they can get your information, because I think it's very, very important. And certainly, for those of you out there in the listening audience, I think William Grigg is certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen we have, framing the ideas as true as what is happening into a clear presentation so we can understand. Well, William, would you like to just go ahead and tell people how they can get in touch with your writings and how they can get in touch with your PayPal button?
Well, Dr. Stan, I appreciate that. My chief outlet is my blog, which is called Pro Libertate. The easiest way to get to it is to use Google or another search engine and type in my name, William Grigg, and probably the first return will be the Pro Libertate blog. Pro Libertate is spelled ProLibertate. But if you use William Grigg as the search term, Pro Libertate blog should be the first one. The direct web address is freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Usually updated once or twice a week. I just finished posting a 3,200 word essay. Those take a little bit longer than some of the shorter form journalism that I engage in. And at the bottom of every essay, there's a PayPal button. For those who have access to PayPal and are interested in helping to keep me in business and help me provide for my family, and something I really appreciate, you can click on the PayPal button at the bottom of every essay. Trying to find a better location for it, but we're going to be tweaking the format to make that button more accessible. But once again, Pro Libertate, the blog, is my chief outlet. A lot of what I write is republished at lewrockwell.com, L-E-W Rockwell, Norman Rockwell, L-E-W Rockwell.com. I also contribute essays for a number of other sites that I'm going to have to collate and make it available through links on my blog. But those are my two main outlets right now, are Pro Libertate and lewrockwell.com.
And don't forget, of course, he writes the monthly newsletter for Radio Liberty. And I will tell you, William, that last newsletter that you sent us, the October newsletter, is devastating. That even affected me after 50 years. Wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be talking to you next week.
God bless.
And you too. Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope, of course, you enjoy the weekly conversations with William Grigg. And basically, of course, we hope that you'll want to subscribe to the Radio Liberty family of supporters, and you can read William's articles there. You'll get our four best tapes of the month. Of course, we post them up on the Internet, and you can actually read them on the Internet without a charge. But if you're in a position to help us financially, we could certainly use your help. We, of course, have to come up with $500,000 a year to maintain the network that we have of stations and shortwave and regular radio and Internet and certainly the electronic means of communicating with people, stations. We probably have 40, 50 or more stations now. We had to drop at least one of the networks we had and some of the shortwave, but we still have a sound networks across America where people are hearing the truth. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, because it will explain to you exactly what is going on today. You need to get my talk on the dark secret and on the forbidden secret, and they both come with syllabuses. You need to get my talk on Agenda 21, the covert plan, and that comes with the syllabus as well. Now, you don't have to get the syllabus. They are discounted if you get them along with the talks. But they're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know about the secret cabal that, of course, controls our nation, you really would want to read David Rockefeller's memoirs. We're in 405. He talks about the secret cabal that he's a member of that's working against the best interests of the United States. Those are his words, not mine, page 405. And, of course, we repeat much of this in many of our talks. But we have the book, Memoirs by David Rockefeller, tells how his daughters go down to visit Fidel Castro. Why would David Rockefeller's daughters go down regularly to visit Fidel Castro? Because, ladies and gentlemen, nothing as you think it is. And then, of course, you'd certainly want to get my interview with Ambassador Earl Smith. That's in the DVD called The World Revolution. The World Revolution. You'll hear my interview with Ambassador Smith. He'll tell you how we brought communism to Cuba, knowing full well Fidel Castro was a communist. We installed a communist intentionally. Our number 1-800-544-8927.
Let us all be grateful for a land so fair as we raise our voices in a solemn prayer. God bless America. That I love, stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above, from the mountain.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour radio show. It is the 2nd of November. It is Friday. It is 2012, and we're glad you're there. Absolutely. I'm going to play a song dedicated to Ralph in Michigan today. Ralph and Josh and Kathy. Ralph and Kathy, they're married in Michigan. You know them.
Yes.
I got so many emails entitled with the subject line, "Woohoo, we got a can opener."
Yeah.
If you all heard last Friday's program. Thanks to all of you that sent me the emails that we were excited for Ralph as he had just gotten his can opener, new can opener. Doesn't take much to excite a Power Hour audience,
well,
you know.
Those can be pretty important at
times. That's right. Anyway, we're going to have a good time today. You're going to be glad you tuned in because we are going to have some fun. We have fun scheduled at the Power Hour today, and we also in the second hour have an incredible jazz trumpeter who's going to visit the Power Hour. He's well known in Austin. I mean, like, well known. And he has agreed to come on.